So people say that chattel slavery was alien to us, but insofar as you can exchange human beings with money, so far as human beings were considered to be wealth, far more valuable than land, with that you cannot totally dismiss the idea that there's some element of chattel slavery that had got nothing to do with Europeans, right? Because people were buying and selling human beings, right? They may not have absolute control over these people like they sought to enforce on American plantations. By American, I mean Americas. But once you are buying and selling human beings, once you could inherit human beings, there is an element of chattel slavery there.
Hello and welcome to a new series in our Connecting Communities podcast called Challenging Perspectives, Accra, Her People and the Danes. My name is Abna Sewa, editor of Akkadi magazine, and you were just listening to Herman von Hesse, assistant professor of African art history at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign in the USA. Our chat with Herman is the first in a series on the Danish presence in 17th, 18th and 19th century Accra that we hope to share with you. In the first interview of this series, Herman gives us a brief overview of life in Accra prior to European settlement. He outlines how the Danes established themselves in and around Accra and draws distinctions and similarities between the European trade and people and the indigenous practice in what we now call Ghana. Our aim with this and subsequent interviews with historians and academic experts is to dig deeper into our understanding of what life was like in Accra, primarily, for the average woman, man and child, and explore what impact the presence of Europeans over the centuries has had on the exchange of ideas, how it shaped our cultures, languages, traditions, trade, and more. We call this series Challenging Perspectives because we hope that these discussions will encourage us all to interrogate and challenge our perspectives, increase our knowledge, and inspire us to keep asking those important questions. We hope you enjoy.
My name is Herman von Hesse. I'm an assistant professor of African art history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Before that, I was a postdoc at Rice University in Houston, Texas, and I got my PhD in African history with an art history minor. So I mostly do the material and urban histories of Africa and its global diasporas from the early modern period till the present time. By early modern period, I mean since the 15th century till recent times. So basically, this is what I do. And yeah.
Brilliant. And I'd read something about you doing some archival and research history, but specifically looking at Denmark, which is the country we'll be speaking about, Brazil as well, the USA, as well as Ghana.
Yeah, so in terms of my research experience, my archival research experience, I've done archival research in the US, in Denmark, in Ghana, and in the UK. And so besides archival research, I've also done research in Brazil, and so on. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Because my broader interests, even beyond Ghana, my broader interests is this wider Atlantic world, during the slave trade and its transition to the so-called legitimate commerce, through to the colonial period, and into more contemporary times. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Well, hopefully we can dig into your knowledge on the Danish presence in what we now call Ghana. So, well, along the sort of coast, because we're specifically looking at Accra and those neighbouring areas. As I mentioned to you, the books that we've been focused on have looked at that period between the late period, actually. I know that the Danish were quite late when it comes to entering into the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, but we're looking at that period that they were there. So that's mid 17th century up until 1850 when they sold Christiansburg Castle to the English. But before we do that, I wanted to just get an idea from you because you have knowledge of before that period, before the Europeans were there, what it was like in that Accra area before this European presence.
Yeah, great. So before the Portuguese were the first Europeans to show up on the Accra coast, or what became the Accra coast on the southeastern Gold Coast. But before that, most of the Ga had founded this thriving polity that dominated the Accra plains. The later European residents called it Great Accra. Right, Accra being a sort of Europeanized way of saying the Akan term for the Ga nation, which was Nkran, right? But then the Ga themselves, they called their nation Ga, right? Or Ganga, right? It's a simply a reduplication of Ga, which it referred to this sort of rowdy, but disciplined driver ants that would, stink you and cause you a hell of a pain. So so it's not clear when the Ga people came to have this identity as a people, but they originated together with the Dangbe. They are very closely related to the Dangbe linguistically and culturally. So the Ga people, I should say the proto-Ga, because they were not Ga yet, right? So the proto-Ga broke from the Dangbe sometimes towards the beginning of the second millennium of the Common Era, and they began to spread westwards into the Accra Plains. Now, this was not an exodus, right? A lot of the time, missionary educated cultural writers and historians, were impressed by all these stories of exodus in the Bible, so they tend to apply that to the so-called migration tradition. So this should not be taken as an exodus, but it should be. But these were different family groups, moving back and forth between the Eastern Accra Plains and the Western Accra Plains, and intermingling and intermarrying with the various Guan-speaking peoples already inhabiting the Accra Plains, so people like the Obutu, the Kpishin, and so on, and the Trepon, right? Remnants of the Trepon could still be found on the Kwiapim Ridge, the people like the Late and so on, right? So clearly by the 15th and 16th centuries, the Ga had assimilated a lot of the Aboriginal, peoples on the Western Accra Plains, and they incorporated them into their social structures, and also even borrowed a lot from their religious traditions and so on. So the Guan also influenced the Ga, right? So by the close of the 15th century, Great Accra or Nkrampong, right, had been established by Ayikushi. So by the 15th century, had been established by Ayikushi, some of whose descendants would interact first with the Portuguese, right? And they didn't allow them to build any forts. They drove them away. So by 1642, the Ga King Mampong Okai would grant the Dutch, permission to build Fort Crèvecoeur, which became Usher fought after the English, you know, after the Dutch ceded it to the English in 1868. But we're not going there. So Krefkoa became like the first permanent fort, because the Ga had sort of destroyed the Portuguese fort, driven the Portuguese away, right? Because they didn't. So this also shows the sort of power and the upper hand that you know, Gold Coast polities or states had over Europeans, right? I mean, this was not the Americas. This was not the Americas, right? The Europeans didn't colonize at this point, right? They were masters of the oceans, right? Kwesi Kwanadu likes to put it this way. The Europeans were masters of the oceans, right? Whilst Africans were the masters of the land. Maybe save Cape Town, which had a Dutch colony from the 17th century. So from the middle of the 17th century. That's completely different. Yeah. So then Mapungkai's, you know, son, Ukonkwe, right, was the one who granted the land that the Christiansborg, or to give it its fancy Danish pronunciation, Christiansborg, so gave permission to the Danes to build Christiansborg on the current site. But before that, there was a Swedish lodge over there, right? But then it was completely sacked, you know, because again, there were internal rivalries between the Swedish establishments, and so it didn't last long. It just withered away. So this guy called Heinrich Kalev, who some people say was Polish, but strange that he had a German name anyway. So he betrayed the Danish, sorry, the Swedish establishment, and got the king, Ukonkwe, to agree to what would become Christiansborg. So by 1661, the foundations of Christiansborg has been laid. So there's a document about this transaction giving, you know, Danes rights to the land, you know. But so all of these were sort of worked out by the middle of the 17 by 1661, right? But then the southeastern Gold Coast, or Usu, was not the first place that the Danes had a fort, right? The Danes have had a fort much earlier, still within the 17th century, not far from Cape Coast Castle, which originally was the Swedish headquarters, right? Eventually, the English would capture the Swedish fort Carolusburg, which, you know, the English renamed Cape Coast Castle, right? So the Danes could not stand all this competition. So eventually, they made Christiansborg the headquarters of their slaving enterprise on the Gold Coast. And that this would happen in 1685. Right. So these were the beginnings of Danish trade, initially, like other Europeans, initially in gold. But from the 17th century onwards, the trade in human beings become very important, right? Because the Danes, like other Europeans, had colonies in the Americas. So the Danes had the Danish West Indies, right? What became the US Virgin Islands in 1917? So this was Saint John or Saint Jan, Saint Thomas, and Saint Croix.
In the following segment, Herman explains the distinction between the European trade in humans and the practice in what we now call Ghana.
So long before the At least 600 years before the transatlantic slave trade, the peoples of what became the Gold Coast and its Akan interior and beyond had various forms of involuntary servitude, you know. And there was a form of what we would call quote unquote slavery, which could be based on a sort of lineage model, where slaves and people of several origins could be made part of the family, though they were a sort of lesser kind of family. Often you hear this this saying in even in contemporary Ghana, people say, "You are my family, but you are not my blood," right? So they had all kinds of social limitations, right? But then also there are other forms of involuntary servitude, what we call the pawns, right? What in Ghana they call awoba, and their clan call awuwa. So basically, these are human collaterals or human mortgages, right? Once you are able to pay off that, so usually with that you use closer members of your family, right? So you use your own children or your nieces and nephews and so on. But then the downside to this was women were preferred, because if you use a woman as a collateral or as a pawn, the master had sexual access to their bodies. They would, have children with them, and that did not affect the debt in any way, right? And then not just their bodies, but their labor, right? So, and then there were, captives, like war captives, and also slaves acquired through tributes. Powerful states would demand tributes in terms of in the form of slaves from less powerful states. You could also buy slaves from the market, because there was an internal slave market, right? So when the transatlantic slave trade, including that of the Danes, when it comes in, it did not, in many ways, it did not radically changed local notions of slavery, right? But it sort of expanded it, right? So when, for example, the Portuguese show up in the late 15th century, they were importing, they saw the demand for slaves on the Gold Coast and its interior, its Akan interior. They saw the demand. So through the advantage of their ships, they met this demand by bringing captives from the Bights of Benin and the Bights of Biafra, which roughly present-day Nigerian coasts. And also even as far down south as Angola and the Congo, right? And so over time, we have several peoples along the coast we call Alata communities, right? So this is supposedly coming from Alada, which is a sort of a polity stuck in between what is now Benin Republic and Nigeria, right? So you realize that things did not radically changed just because Europeans were here, right? We're on the Gold Coast, right? But then all of this would change from the 17th century onwards. In fact, within USU itself, there is an Alata, right? And they have an interesting tradition that says that their ancestors were the ones who were employed to build the castle. I mean, there's a historical truth to that, if you are thinking about how these Alatas were recruited. And then a lot of the time, there's just a mixture of all these people from the Bights and from the so-called slave coast, and then Fanti Kenu men, and I should add women, who knows? So this was the dynamic. But then slavery, local slavery could be harsh, because those who were yet to be assimilated into families suffered some of the most horrendous abuses you think about. And then they were marched from long distances to different slave markets. So people say that chattel slavery was alien to us, but insofar as you can exchange human beings with money, so far as human beings were considered to be wealth, far more valuable than land, with that, you cannot totally dismiss the idea that there's some element of chattel slavery that had got nothing to do with Europeans, right? Because people were buying and selling human beings, right? They may not have absolute control over these people. Like, they sought to enforce on American plantations. By American, I mean America's. But once you are buying and selling human beings, once you could inherit human beings, there is an element of chattel slavery there.
I wanted to refer to Akosua Phurbi's book, The History of A History of Indigenous Slavery in Ghana, and she talks exactly about what you mention as well. I think there's that element, and you're not saying that it was completely like the European process, because you could marry, couldn't you? You could be an enslaved woman and marry, and then you're no longer enslaved, I understand, or it doesn't necessarily follow you, like your descendants aren't necessarily also enslaved or slaves, which was different in the Americas.
Well, ma marriage per se did not make you free. That is the prerogative of the person that you married. So in the Akan world, a lot of men really want to have absolute control over their children, because the Akan matrilineal system would not necessarily give you that right. That right usually goes to your children's maternal uncle, right? So Akan men would buy foreign slaves, by foreign anybody who is not Akan, right? And then with that, they are able to, so they marry these slaves, and they are able to have authority, like stronger authority over their children, right? And there are families who, for reasons of labor shortage and other things, they would buy slaves and incorporate them into the family. But slavery became an indelible mark. And till this very day, there are people, I'm sure you might know some of this, there are people who cannot inherit property and who cannot ascend to the stool, which is the symbol of chiefly authority, just because they were descended from, in the case of the Akan, they were descended from a female ancestress who happens to be of Serval origin. And in the case of the Ga that we're trying to focus on today, a lot of male slaves would be acquired, because since descent is generally traced through the father's line, that becomes a disability for the descendants of this male figure of Serval origin. But otherwise, within patrilineal societies like the Ga, once your mom is a slave, it doesn't really count, right? Because you claim your descent primarily through your father's line, right? So the different systems of succession also play a very important role,
I mean, I'm hearing caste system. I'm thinking India and the caste system. That sounds like the structure you're talking about, if you can never ascend that or escape that.
I'm also very mindful of connecting local systems to other social organizations that is completely different because they have different cultural logics, right? In the case of Ghana, Serval origin always, in contemporary Ghana, Serval origins always become an issue only when people don't know their place. I mean, this is not my view. I'm just saying what, like the culture, like what people have been doing for centuries, right? So maybe if there's a vacant stool, and maybe somebody tries to, tries to ascend to that stool, they will be told, maybe they don't know, maybe their whole life they thought they were royal. So they will be told that, no, this is not, you are our family, but you are not our blood. It's not for you, right? Even sometimes, a lot of the mixed race Ga Danish families, they had lots of domestic slaves, and this is something that everybody of means and even of less means could own slaves, right? But this becomes problematic for those of greater means, even in the 21st century, when descendants of people who were brought into the family, not just Euro-African families, just about any other. I mean, at anywhere in Ghana that you go, not just in Ushu or Accra, you have legal suits, with people saying, "But you are not of the blood. Your ancestors were squatters, so you have to know your place." And cases like this have been to court several times, and almost like all the time, people of several origins tend to lose because for some reason our courts still do not affirm the rights of people of several origins, So when people want to compare these cases with the Americas and say that, "Hey, our system was better," I'm like, not necessarily. I try to throw in this so that we don't glorify the past because it's an African past. There's that tendency to make that comparison with the Americas and say, "Hey, look at our system. It was great, right? If it was great, the Supreme Court would uphold the rights of people of several origins, but it does not."
And just also
Yeah.
this thorny issue about our complicity in the slave trade. And as you've mentioned, if Europeans were coming to a system that was already created where there was a trade in enslaved Africans, does that make it harder for us to denounce it completely because we were complicit to some degree?
Yeah, so here's how I see it. I don't like using terms like complicit or collaborators and so on, right? Because we had our own world, right? And we practiced forms of involuntary servitude. You can call it slavery, which is fine because some of our categories fit, the English term slavery, right? So when Europeans showed up and there was an increasing demand for slave labor in the Americas, it was, I don't want to say it was almost natural because it would seem like I don't find it morally appalling, right? But for the want of a better word, like in their minds, it's not like they were complicit or they were collaborating, right? Because a lot of the people that were taken out, I mean, there were people who were foreign to them, right? So even though our focus is on Ghana was not one country, right? Even in 1954, we saw Asante nationalism. Like even at that time, we were struggling even to become one. How much more in the 17th or 18th century, right? So, and it's no different from in Europe, more in Asia, just about anywhere else in the world, and all these categories of African solidarity and being Ghanaian and so on, these came later on, right? And even nobody identified as African to start with, save the small communities of mixed race people living in the coastal towns of West Africa, or Africans and their descendants in the Americas. I tell people that African Americans and Haitians and so on got an African identity before continental Africans did, right? Because during the Haitian Revolution, Haitians were going around calling themselves Ethiopians and whatnot. African Americans in the 1790s founded a church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church. This was at a time when it was just only mixed race communities along the African coast, and also Africans who had been taken to Europe in the 18th century, Anton Wilhelm Amoo and those guys, they were the ones calling themselves Africans, or Ulaudah Equiano. But apart from that, nobody really knew what Africa meant.
In the following segment, Herman gives historical examples of how the transatlantic slave trade was known to some Africans.
So I was making the point that with all the context and the nuanced picture that I try to paint, I'm not in any way suggesting that Africans on the Atlantic coast were ignorant of what was happening in the Atlantic slave trade. So first of all over the Atlantic coast, there were people who thought, including in Osu, there were people who thought that the leather boots that Europeans wore were made of human flesh or the skin of black people, right? I don't know how the rumor got around. So Europeans were thought of as cannibals, right? So those Africans who were ignorant, this was the view that they held, right? So this tells you that even those who were ignorant knew that what happened at the other side of the Atlantic was not paradise, was not bliss, right? And then there were those who knew. So the Congo, the Kingdom of the Congo with a capital K, they sent several embassies to Bahia, just like Dahomey, just like African merchants from ports of Benguela and Luanda. You know, in Luanda, there were women married to Europeans, to Portuguese and Brazilian men who even owned slave ships that went as far afield as the Caribbean, Rio, Bahia, and Montevideo in Uruguay, right? So, and I learned this from reviewing the works of Sandra Oliveira, who's a Brazilian scholar of the slave trade. She focuses more on the South Atlantic and the connections between Angola and Brazil to the Gold Coast. Interracial marriages were central to the Atlantic slave trade. In USU, without interracial marriages, it would not be possible for the Danish establishment to thrive like it did, you know. And the rulers, the traditional office holders of USU, were also employees of the Danish West India and Guinea Company. I was at a conference and I made this provocative point that the forts and castles along the coast of Ghana were intimate spaces. You know, the adjacent towns and polities around these forts and castles had an intimate relationship with these places, right? Because not only were many of them employees of these companies, they also married their daughters to these white strangers, and that gave them a better deal, right? So if you marry your daughter off to Europeans on the coast, you gain access to all of these imported merchandise, you know, all these textiles and trade goods coming in from Asia and Europe and so on. The European would also have good food. When they are sick, they're taken care of. I mean, life expectancy on the Southeastern Gold Coast was just about 1.5 years for Northern European men, right? So they lived longer. In fact, the German-born Danish physician and a naturalist, Paul Edmund Iset was advising Europeans to eat local food, right? Including palm nut soup, right? And so who was going to prepare that? Who was going to nurse them out of malaria, right? Because European medicine was completely ignorant of tropical ailments, you know. So all of these are quite well documented. Some scholars like Daniela Ibsen had, you know, they've talked about that. But to the average Ghanaian, or and more so to the average black person, these are shocking, right? Because the Europeans were supposed to be bulldozing and conquering everyone, right? And it's shocking. It's shocking to talk about how intimate these spaces were, right? And these adjacent polities, they formed political alliances with the forts, right? So in the case of an Akan siege, because in the on the Southeastern Gold Coast, from the 17th century, we had the Akwamu, we had Achim, and then Asante, conquering and, in successive batches, right? So these European forts, they were also spaces of refuge, and sometimes they even negotiated for the gun when in the case of Akan sieges,
There's
and
one that
this
I
quick
remember.
example. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, when I read, I believe it was Rask. So Selina Wisnes's translation of
Wilson's,
his,
yeah.
and she talks about there being a fight or a war which would have impacted on the local community, and some of them were trying to get into Christiansburg, but I think there was message from the king to say not to get involved in internal politics, so that meant that a lot of people died. I think it was against the Akwamu, so it was the Gars against the Akwamu, but I don't remember the year. But as a result, there was a lot of collateral damage and people died trying to get in for safety into the castle, which I thought was interesting.
Exactly. But on this same point, there was a time in 1728. So the Gar really wanted to throw off Akwamu rule. He wanted to overthrow the Akwamu regime. And the Dutch agreed to help. The British agreed to help. But the Danes were afraid. The Danes were like, you know what? We don't want any trouble with the Akwamu. We don't want the Akwamu descending down here to drive us into the sea. We don't want that. So the Danes reported to the king of Akwamu that this is the plot the Gan people are up to, right? So the Akwamu came down with full force. They burned Tinka, which is Dutch Accra, and then they also burned Nglesin, which is English Accra. So the Gan tried to punish the Danes, They went into alliance with the Achim, and they were able to throw off Akwamu rule in 1730. And the Akwamu had enslaved lots of the Gan people. And funny enough, the presence of the forts and castles is the reason why Akan militarism really became a thing, right? So you see, it's like, the thing that is really causing the chaos is also the same thing that protects. Am I making sense? Exactly. So in 1730, because the Akwamu were brutal, the Akwamu were even selling their own people, right? It's counterintuitive. It doesn't make sense, right? So when the Gan collaborated with the Achim, formed an alliance with the Achim to overthrow the Akwamu, a lot of them were sold into slavery, right? And they ended up in the Danish West Indies, right? So 30 years later, so around 1760, there was a German Moravian missionary called Oldendorp, right? So Oldendorp was, I think it was on St. Thomas, right? Either St. Thomas or St. Jan, one of them. And he met the brother of the king of Akwamu. He met another Akwamu guy who used to be a wealthy slave trader and raider. Then he met someone who was an Akwamu farmer or something like that, right? And these guys had an empire. I mean, I hate saying empire, but they had you can call it Greater Akwamu. So Greater Akwamu extended from the Accra Plains almost to the border of Dahomey, And so they were subjugating the Anglo, all these ever-speaking communities across the Volta, right? So when the Gan and the Achim and the Akan state weakened and destroyed Akwamu, the entire territory of the three Achim states, Bosome, Kotoku, and Abuakwa, used to be part of the core of Akwamu. That used to be Akwamu proper, right? But the Achim expanded, drove all of them away, and then they founded just a, they were reduced to a small polity, which today they still call Akwamu Fie, just around the Adami Bridge before you cross into what is now the Volta region, right? So that was how Akwamu ended, and 30 years later, Akwamu royalty were still being interviewed in the Danish West Indies by Odin Dob. Odin Dob never visited the Gold Coast, but he learned a lot about the political scene on the Gold Coast by these enslaved Akwamo people.
Wow.
Then Achim stayed in Accra and Osu and collected the land rents from the forts. And this was something that the Gao should be collecting, not Achim, because this was not their territory, right? But 1742, Asante also came and basically beheaded Frimpong Manso, who is, I believe, the king of Kotoku then. And Achim was basically run over, right? And then the Gan people got into this strange relationship with the Gan people. So then again, the Danes sort of protected in 1742. I mean, it's in the document. It's funny, like, you well, not funny for people living at the time, right? Like, a lot of the leaders of the Gan sought refuge in some of the forts. And then there was this particular leader of Teshin. His name was Numo Notechie, right? Mm. So basically, Chie was interviewed by the Danish slave trader and official at the castle, Louville Roma. So Roma was basically...
Yeah.
having a conversation with some of these Gan leaders, right? And it describes how, so Chie was talking about how he was having this lucky stone in his hands because he had to plead for the Danes to intervene. And he said he kept rubbing this good luck, whatever, lucky stone charm. And that amulet, he believed, spoke for him and convinced the Danes the need to sort of shelter them under the guns of the fort, right? And Chie would talk about how, had it not been for the Danes who pleaded his cause, you know, like, his people would have been annihilated, right? So when people in 21st century Ghana are cheering, hey, our state conquered all these places, I tell them to chill, because, like, the whole communities were annihilated, right? And a lot of chiefly titles, Osaberima, Tunfo, all these things, they are connected to slave raiding, right? Because these were war titles, you know. So a lot of our traditional institutions and how they were structured were sort of informed by this militaristic period in our pre-colonial history, right? So it was very messy.
Yeah.
And in fact, talking about my work, so in my work, I sort of talked about stone houses, Aban, which you know, which means, initially it meant protection, whether of a sacred groove or of a fence or something like that. But with time, Aban came to mean
government.
The solid stone walls of the fort.
Does it not also mean
and
government?
That would come later, right? But then it came to mean castles, forts, stone houses. But with time, Aban also came to mean government. Right? So the word Aban, you know, protection, right? It underwent what linguists call broadening, right? And government, because Western style government came from the Aban, came from within the walls of the fort, right? And to have an Aban is to have protection. So today, Akan people call policemen Aban. So that's how it is.
Yeah.
It has a Gan cognate, Afaban. When I was small, my mom used to tell me to pray to Jesus so that Ibafu or he Afaban, right? So you see the same analogy, right?
Yeah.
So that Jesus will erect a fence wall around me. So so it follows that logic, right? And in Fanti, there is a name, Abando, which means love of stone houses, right? And the appellation for that name is Fiokun. So love of stone houses, which is a personal name, and names have appellations. So Fiokun means from war, right? So all of this is connected to the Fanti and how they had to deal with the chaos of the slave trade and raids and expansion, state expansion, and so on.
And yet, because that was one thing that I wanted to talk about, what it was like for ordinary people. You know, when we talk about the slave trade, it's usually done in quite a binary way. So you have the, and obviously what you've explained in this small amount of time is shows how complex it was, and those that were, you know, trading your people, you yourself may also have been doing that, were also providing you with protection. So how do we, you know, get through the quagmire of all of that, understanding it?
So it's hard because, for especially people of African descent living in the West, in the Americas, a lot of them are still dealing with the legacies of slavery and so on. So how then could you tell them that this was far more complicated than simply a white-black binary? So what I say is this. Well, you can say Europeans provided a market for it, and they completely transformed slavery and made it into a modern money generating capitalist machine. So that's what I can say, but Africans, for various reasons, and I've explained, when I say Africans, they were not one people, different groups. They participated in it for all kinds of reasons. I will probably end with what Asante Hini Osaibunsu told Bowditch. Britain was trying to get Asante to stop the slave trading, right? Britain, right, the biggest slave trading country ever, was not trying to convince an African nation to stop selling slaves. So the king simply said, well, I mean, if I have vassal states and some of them prove to be insolent and they want to secede and I bring them back and into the kingdom or whatever, and I punish them by killing some of them and selling some of them as slaves, how could this be wrong? How could this be wrong? Isn't that what the Quran prescribes? Isn't that what your own Bible also prescribes? And in England, when you wage wars, what do you do with them?
What
And
year was
the
this?
king's, this was in the 1820s, right? And the king's response sounds logical. I don't know. Does it sound logical to you?
I mean, it sounds like what loads of other peoples have done. Yes. When you have prisoners of
Exactly.
war, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, and it's morally, of course, it's appalling, but when you try to not play devil's advocate, but then when you try to look at it critically, you would realize that the Africans were those powerful African states were operating on a logic. And it's, in as much as this is morally appalling, it helps us to understand how complicated this whole business of enslaving African bodies meant, right? And then there are people from the diaspora who say that, hey, you people in Ghana sold us. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, it's not like that, because your ancestors, your African ancestors, also sold my African ancestors. So could I also blame you for that? The example of Akwamu that I gave, there were Akwamu people who enslaved Africans, right? But when those people also got the upper hand, what did they do? They also sold them into slavery. So clearly, it's not about reselling you. It's about your ancestors could also have sold my ancestors. You never know. So it's not a time to be doing this blame game. Like Afro Brazilians who were freed in Bahia came to West Africa and was they were part of the revival of the illegal slave trade from the Southeastern Gold Coast, from the so-called Slave Coast, and from the Bights.
Are you talking about
So
the
it's
Tabon
not.
people? The
The
Tabon?
Tabon were even, yes, but they were even small fish in terms of the Afro-Brazilian population, they had connections with lots of Afro-Brazilians on the slave coast, Togo, Benin, Lagos, and so on. And they were trafficking human beings in collaboration with Ghana rulers, you know. And most of the captives were coming from Asante. And then by that time, Accra had become a stubborn place for slave dealing. And most of the people doing this were the chiefs and Afro-Brazilians collaborating with Kumasi. And then down along the coast, there were networks in Angolan and in what is now Togo, Benin, and Lagos, where there were all these Afro-Brazilian and some white Brazilian traders doing all this stuff, right? So it's not us and them, because those who were also sold, they left wives, husbands, children, grandchildren, and descendants who mourned them for generations. So the fact that I'm in Ghana or I'm in Africa and you are in Brazil or the United States does not mean that the people here sold the people there. It's messy. I hope I was able to explain the
No,
point
you
rather
have.
well.
You have, and that's interesting because I think people forget about those that have been left behind. But I just wanted to end with this question because recently we had a march in London fighting for reparations. We've got the fight to get some of the antiquities back that are scattered across the world. And there'll be some that might think that some of the comments you've made maybe weakens that argument to get the apologies that we've recently heard from the King of the Netherlands and all sorts of things like that. What is your response?
Yeah, I think there's some merit to Caribbean to people from the diaspora, descendants of enslaved people in Brazil, the Caribbean, the US, Mexico, Cuba, and so on, right? I think they have a legitimate case for reparations, right? Because if your labor is exploited by this capitalist money-making machine for close to 400 years and you were never compensated, I think there should be some form of reparations. I don't know, maybe not giving people cash. But when it comes to Africa, I don't think so. You know, because like as a historian, like ultimately the Atlantic trade was unequal. You know, because on hindsight, we know it was not an equal trade, you know. But then looking at how sovereign African states participated in this gruesome business that ended up racializing, I mean, because that's the basis, for the most part, that's the basis of Western racialization of Africans and people of African descent. So I don't think we need, I don't think there should be anything like reparations. We can talk about the colonial era. That's a different subject, you know, but this focus is on the slave trade, the transatlantic slave trade, which by far is different from the colonial system, the colonial rule. The fact that African sovereignties were extinguished, that's different. So that's a different conversation.
Okay. Thank you, Herman. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to our conversation with Herman von Hesse, Assistant Professor of African Art History at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign in the USA. This episode was edited and produced by Camo, and all the books we've read or referred to in this segment have been listed in the show notes. We call this series Challenging Perspectives because we hope that these discussions will encourage us all to interrogate and challenge our perspectives, increase our knowledge, and inspire us to keep asking those important questions. Tell us what you thought of this discussion and if you've learned anything new. Thank you for listening to this episode. To listen to more content like this, visit our monthly Acadi magazine Connecting Communities podcast on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, or wherever you listen to your audio. Follow our news on acadimagazine.com and acadimagazine.co.uk and access exclusive early release content and discounts at ko-fi.com/acadimagazine. The music in this episode is called Life No Day Easy by Chechaku and the Super Pong Stars and is a special remix exclusively for Acadi Magazine. Super Pong Stars is a high-octane patchwork of Ghana's indigenous genres, including palm wine music, high life, Afrobeat and Afro-funk. You can find out more about the band on their Instagram, Super Pong Stars. Thank you.